been working on all semester has been these morally difficult situations. And I decided that it's not always good to do negative moral dilemmas, and it would be all right once in a while to look at the opposite spectrum. And that is what we're going to do today. Now, the poem that you have in front of you is a poem that I actually found on the Yad Vashem website. And I don't know about you, but I think those of us who are of a certain age, and I think almost every Jewish teen perhaps goes through this issue when you know, that stage when you read Holocaust books, mm-hmm. right? And then the next thing you start having things, what would I have done if I lived then? Right, and I think some of that comes out in nightmares also, probably, you know, the coming, where are you going, how would you escape, would you be one of those who survived? And that seems to be the thing that we review over in our minds. How many of us, though, have flipped the situation over and asked ourselves that question? If we were Gentiles living in that situation, could I have done the same thing? Now, I haven't seen this, but according to my teenage students, they tell me that there's a television reality show called What Would You Do? And they say they have it, there's an American version and there's an Israeli version. And what they do is, anybody? You've seen it. And what they do is apparently is they create these scenarios. For instance, there's a scenario where they have an Arab walks into the coffee shop, and the coffee shop is full. Now the worker, you know, there are people who are plants, and the worker turns to the Arab and says, "Oh, we don't serve Arabs." And to see how the people react. Another one that's actually very interesting is they're in the park, a public park, and they have a woman who's beating up a man. You know, that's right. So, and it's interesting because when it happens the other way, if it's a man hitting a woman, people tend to get involved. It's the other way. There's one where a soldier gives his gun to a little kid and teaches the kid how to like start managing. There are a whole bunch of these different scenarios, and it's interesting. It's a sociological study to see how would people react. But I think I have never seen the show, but I imagine that what people find interesting in the show is that question in the back of your mind that you say to yourself, well, what would I do? How would I react in that situation? And I think that this poem is really a very strong statement of this idea and of this question of would I be able to do what the righteous Gentiles did, risking their lives, themselves, their families, in order to save other people. And what I really like to do is look at two situations in this week's Parsha where essentially we have situations that are very similar. We're going to the source that begins with Shmuel Perek Aleph, the one that says the Miyaldot. So let's review the psukim that you're all familiar with. It's the sheet again that says Miyaldot, and we'll come back to the other sheet afterwards. Vayomer Melech Mitzrayim leMiyaldot haIvriot asher shem haachat Shifra v'shem haShnia Pu'ah. Let me just remind you that let's go back and see what is the beginning of Sefer Shmuel talk about. Now, there's a fascinating parallel, which we don't have time to go into because we do want to cover two different subjects today, but just to start thinking, Sefer Bereishit talks about the creation of the world. Sefer Shmuel talks about the creation of a nation. In both situations, we have the Vayar Elokim et Ha'or Ki Tov, which we have in Bereishit, and in Shmot, the psukim that we have after that, remember, is the birth of Moshe, where his mother takes a look and she sees that he is Ki Tov. It's the same expression. And as you know, how did she know that he was Ki Tov? We'll get to that in a minute, but the idea is that because the whole house filled with light. Okay? And obviously the light of creation, the light of Torah, the light of redemption, repeats itself as all. But just the way it was God who created the world, we're going to see that in Shemot, the creation is really coming through the women. And here, the beginning of Shemot Perek Aleph begins with the Jews in Egypt. Paro is feeling threatened by the increase of the people, and therefore he comes up with various plans to get rid of them. So he says to the midwives, one who's named Shifra and one who says Pua, Vayomer, Bialchem et ha'ivriot, u'item al ha'avanim. When you come to birth the women, look on the birthstone. Im benhu vehantenoto. If it's a son, you know, make something happen that he should not survive. Veim bati vechaya. And if it is a daughter, she should live. And according to Rav Lau, he points out that Paro is the first to be making a selection. Yes, in the concentration camps, it was based on, you know, physical strength, but here Paro is making a selection based on gender. Ben, die, girl, live. Vatir ena hamiyodot et Elohim. These midwives feared God. And they did not listen to the king of Mitzrayim. And they allowed the children to live. Today, in modern day Israel, we would call this Sarev Pekuda. That's a term you should all recognize, right? That this was something that, you know, the kids in Gush Katif were asking the soldiers to refuse their command, refuse your orders. So their orders were kill, and they say no. So then the king calls to these miyaldot, and he says to them, why are you ignoring the command and allowing the children to live? And the midwives say to Paro, you're wrong, the Jews are not like the Egyptian, ki chayot hena, for they are animal-like, b'terem tavo alehen hamiyaldot bayilodu, because even before we get there, they've given birth to the child. Vayitav elokim lamiyaldot, and God does a goodness with these midwives, vayerev ha'am vayatsumu ma'od, and the nation multiplies in great numbers. Vayhi ki yiru hamiyaldot et Elohim, and it was when these miyaldot feared God, vayas lahem batim, and it was made for them homes. Vayitzav Paro l'chol amo lemar, so that plan didn't work, so Paro creates another plan where he says to his nation, kol haben hayilod hayaora tashlichuhu b'chol habat techayun. Again, boys need to be thrown into the Nile and girls can live. Now, we have many difficulties when we read these psukim. What are some of the difficulties that jump out to you when you read these psukim? Again, it's a story you've learned before, but we want to try to look at it with new lenses.
Why did the midwives go against them?
Okay, so that question is very much connected to another question, and that is, who are these midwives, and where do they get the strength of character to refuse? And now remember, we're not talking about like Israeli army refuse a command. The worst case scenario, what happens to you is you end up in jail. We're talking about refusing a king who happens also to be a dictator. Okay? And what happens usually when you refuse a dictator? Right. Which makes us give us, I think that would be a third question, is why doesn't he kill them? Okay? That is a good question. And I think those three are all connected. Okay, how could it be, if the nation is multiplying at such a number, that there are only two midwives? Another problem. Okay, we'll talk about it. What else?
Maybe there are others that aren't mentioned.
Obviously, we'll get to it. We'll talk about that. That's all connected to who they are.
Well, why did he decide to kill the,
what's the idea? If you want to kill out, the Nazis didn't separate between men and women, and And genetically, if you want to get rid of the Jewish people, who do you have to get rid of?
The women.
The women. Right, you have to get rid of the women because the Judaism follows after the mother. So by leaving the women alive, what was his thought process? That's one way of getting around it. Okay? Let's not answer, let's just ask the questions first, and then we'll talk about the answers. I think that some of the other answers, let me ask another question about...
When they're not necessarily Jewish.
Right, so that's the question we're going to ask, is who those, that's part of the same question, is who are those midwives?
But also the men could work afterwards.
Okay.
He's destroyed his workforce, the whole purpose.
So that continues with what is our issue. Why?
Yes, why so many? You know, we don't hear about it ever again.
Right, so that's, I think that you're hitting on also a much larger question, and that is really, what is the purpose of this story? We could just say, you know, Paro killed the people. One sentence. Why do I need this whole business in order to get us into the Yetziat Mitzrayim? I think you're asking a really fundamental question.
It seems like the story is different. Like, first they don't kill them, and then he says, okay, now you kill the children.
Right, that's what I'm saying. You could have done it in one sentence without the duplication, and we would have gotten to the exact same place. And let me just throw out two other things. Notice this. When the Mialdot say that the Ivriot are kichayot hena, is that a compliment or a insult? Question. And finally, what's this business about God rewarding them? And who's making... Look at verse 21 carefully. Verse 21 presents a problem. And it was when the Mialdot feared God. And then, Vaya'as lahem batim. Who made houses for whom? Mm-hmm. Verse is completely unclear. So let's try to see if we can answer some of these questions and still leave time to get to our next personality. So first of all, let's talk about who were these Mialdot. And there are actually three possibilities that we see within the commentators. The most famous one is the one that you are familiar with, which you see in source number 3. Source number 3 is the Gemara in Masechet Sotah, where it says, Vayomer melech Mitzrayim lemialdot ha'ivriot, Rav Ushmuel. One says, Isha ubita. One of them says it's a mother and her daughter. V'chanomer, and the other one says, Kala v'chamota, a mother and a daughter-in-law. And so who would that be? Isha ubita would be Yocheved and Miriam. And if it's a Kala v'chamota, then it would be Yocheved and her daughter-in-law Elisheva, who married Aharon. Correct. Okay, now, how do we get it? And we'll continue in the Gemara in a minute. Let's just stop for a minute. As we've mentioned here before, in a class, when you study Torah, there is something called the law of conservation of personalities. And the law of conservation of personalities tells us that when you meet a person, Shifra, Pua, who we never meet again, who all we miss this one time, the Torah tries to connect them with somebody else we know. The only we know by name at that time period were Yocheved, Miriam, and Elisheva. So that is how the Medrash works. Since they are the only women we know, we are assuming that these anonymous people are actually these people. That's correct. Okay, so that we're going to get to that in a minute. Who are these? Why and why do they call them Shifra and Pua if their names are Miriam and Yocheved? I want you to keep in the back of your mind that we are starting to read the book that's called Shmot. Names. Okay, keep that in mind as well. Now, there's another problem when I say to you Yocheved and Miriam, which I think is the most common answer that most of you are familiar with. How many years older is Miriam than Moshe? No, she's the oldest. Aharon is 3 years older. She's six. That's correct. Because she is 6 years old. Maybe Elisheva could be a little bit older than that. So it really does make it a little difficult. Married. Somebody she married an older woman. That's what I can't, you know, we understand that that is here a problem. The Maharsha explains like this. You don't have this, but the number of times where there are two people mentioned, just listen to the psukim. Ule eved yolad shnei banim. Shem ha'echad peleg, ki biyamav niflaga ha'aretz, v'shem achiv yoktan. Ve'et shnei baneha, shem ha'echad Gershom, v'shem ha'echad Eliezer. V'yisharu shnei anashim b'machane, shem ha'echad, v'shem ha'sheni. If the pasuk was going to be consistent, whenever we have two people, the pasuk here should read, v'yom ha'tzayim l'miyaldot ha'ivriot, shnei ha'miyaldot, shem ha'echad shifra, v'shem ha'sheni pua. By the fact that the pasuk here is different than all those other circumstances where we have the introduction of two people, therefore the Maharsha says we must know them from someplace else, and therefore they do not need that same sort of introduction. Now let's say hypothetically, I said you don't have those verses. If anybody's interested, I'll give them to you afterwards. Yes. But it says Shnei Hamialdot. That's what you're missing. There were two of them. The first one. Right, but you're missing the introduction. All those other ones says there were two sons, the first and the second. Here it doesn't say there were two Mialdot. That's what you're missing. Okay. Let's assume for a minute that it is Yocheved, Miriam, Shifra. Why doesn't the Torah then use their given names? Why use these names that we never see again, we never hear from them again? What would be the motivation behind doing something like that?
Well, how do we know that they're Jew?
Well, I'm going to come to that in a second. I'm going to answer that question one more second.
Okay,
so I came up with a couple of issues. First of all, I was thinking that perhaps it's like a code name. You know, when you're a spy and you're doing something against the regime, you don't keep your real name, right? Everybody has some sort of code name, so perhaps that's one of the reasons here that they're traveling incognito, and that's why they're not using the name. The second possibility is perhaps the Torah wants to say, if it was Shifrin Yocheved, Miriam would say, well, they're Neviot, you know, they're something we can't even relate to those kind of people, you know, they do different things than the common people. By giving them names of people we don't know, of nobodies, essentially the Torah is telling us that the ability to stand up against moral evil is something that anybody can do. You don't have to be a Shifra and a Miriam, or Yocheved and a Miriam. You can be a Shifra and a Pua. The other possibility is that these are actually not names, but these are actually job descriptions. For instance, today, you know, you have a job, somebody's a doula. Well, I'll tell you a funny story. I met this summer a woman in my Moetza whose name is Yael HaKabasit. I thought Kabasit was her last name. I didn't realize that Kabasit is her job title, which she's the one who's responsible to make sure that every child is in school. That's the job title. But really, there's somebody in my Yishuv named Kabasa, so I thought Kabasit was her last name. I didn't know enough Hebrew to know that that was her last name. So it could be here that Shifra and Pua are also not necessarily names. So for instance, if you jump back into that Gemara that we were looking at, on the third line, in source number 3, Lama Nikra Shma Shifra. What is the name Shifra? What's the root of the word? Not that interesting, but to fix, lishaper, to fix, shem mishaperet et havlad, that's one answer. Davar acher, shifra, sheparu, from the word not lishaper, but from pruervu, to multiply, sheparu v'ravu Yisrael b'yameha, pu'a, zu Miriam, v'lam nikrashma pu'a, shahaita po'a umotzia et havlad. What is that? It seems to be that she was the one who was like the breathing coach. It's almost like an onomatopoeia. Pu'ah. Pu'ah. that it's that kind of thing, that she was one, which makes sense if she is the younger child, that her mother is doing the technique and she's, you know, you can do this, you know, rooting them on. And davar acher shehaya po'ah beruach hakodesh, that she used to speak out in ruach hakodesh, and she would say atida imi sheteled ben shemoshia et Yisrael, and that is a medrash that we know. But we're seeing here is that we're saying that these are not names, but in this situation they are job descriptions. Now, what we have just done, and this is the approach of the Gemara, this is the approach of Rashi, and it's all based on the words miyaldot ha-ivriot. Ha-ivriot means the Jewish midwives, with the hey ha-yidiyah meaning midwives that we know. And this is the grammatic way that appears in all of Torah.
Isn't there a Makon Pua?
Yes. Based on exactly this. That's where they get their name from. Now, as opposed to this common reading, there is a second reading which appears in Philo and Josephus and the Medrash and Shadal and Abarbanel. And they all say, Milot la mieldot ha'ivriot does not mean the Jewish midwives, but rather means the midwives of the Jews. Now, the logic for this is that there are a number of things that might prove this reading correct. What would prove this reading correct?
That they have names, that they're people we don't know.
They're people that we don't know because they're non-Jews.
More logical to have
them. It's more logical that the king would call an Egyptian woman and say to her, kill them. It also might explain to us perhaps why the king doesn't kill them. If they're his own subjects, he might not treat them the same way he would certainly treat a Jew. And another thing you'll notice, twice the Pesukim point out, once in Yud Zayin and once in Chaf Aleph, that these midwives are God-fearing. If they were Jews, you don't have to say that. By the fact that twice it points it out, that indicates to us perhaps that that is something unusual. And if you look at source number 9, I brought you one of these sources so you could see it inside. In source number 9, there's the Shadal who tells us, Dat Chazal, Unculus Rashbam Ramban, Shehayu Hamiyaldot Ha'elu Mizera Yisrael. And that's what I pointed out to you, that is the accepted reading, that these were Jewish midwives. V'dat HaMeturgaman HaAlexandri, V'HaYurimus, Yosefus Flavius, V'dan Yitzchak Abarbanel, Shehayu HaMitzriot Miyaldot HaIvriot. Then that's what he says, V'chein Nira, and that's what it seems to me, that these were midwives of the Jews. Because it wouldn't make logical sense that you ask a Jew to kill another Jew. And remember, he tried to do this because he wanted to keep it secret. Like, he didn't want it to be known that there was mass execution going on, and he's trying to make it look natural. Children die in childbirth, you know, all the time. It happens. So, therefore, that is the second possibility. And I say you can argue within yourselves, you know, the merits of both of those positions. And it's a question we need to ask ourselves. Does it change our understanding of this story when we look at the Mieldot as Gentiles?
Yes.
Yeah, I think it does. The third is a combination view, which you have in source 6 and 7. If you turn to source 6 and 7, you'll notice the Medrash Tidashev says, V'od ki nashim chasidot giyoriot min hagoyim. Then in essence, they were Gentiles, but they converted. Okay, and there you get your combination view, because they are Gentiles. It explains what they're doing, explains why they do. And if you look at the list, who are these converts? Hagar, Asnat, the wife of Yosef, Tzipora, Shifra, Pua. Okay, you've got it right there. And then you have it again there. Pardon? We'll get to that. I'll get to that. Oh, Shabbos, I'm going to get to that. And if you look at source number 7, you'll see the same thing. Sheshifra v'pua, Mitzriot hayu, they were actually Egyptians, mitchila, v'nit gairu. Why would they do that? I think the reason they're doing that is this is the combination view. you know, why would they be willing to risk their lives to save these people? And so we're sort of saying that, and I really think, why would they think of converting? Now remember, and this is going to point that we're going to get to later also, the concept of conversion before Matan Torah doesn't really exist. So I think when the Medrash is talking about conversion, it really is essentially saying throwing in your lot with the Jews. And I think that, right, so I don't think it's, you know, they went to the mikvah, you know, that kind of idea, but it's this idea of identifying, and they are certainly risking their lives because the king is asking them to do something immoral and they are refusing. Now, there are a whole bunch of other explanations for Shifra and Puah, which I am going to skip. You have them in source number 4. You can look at them. I do want to share just one with you because it's so interesting. Shifra, what else do we know today that has the root word Shin Pei Resh? The Shaper, we said already. The concept of a shofar. Wow. Concept of a shofar. So I saw in one of the commentators that she was the first one to actually create some sort of breathing tube. And it was an artificial, you know, in order for her to do CPR to help the baby begin to breathe properly. And I thought it was just fascinating. Anyway, so you look at the different shifpuas of the different names. I'm going to skip those for now. I do want to point out, as you all pointed out, that if you look at source number 2, source number 2 is the Ibn Ezra, who, as you ladies asked, it cannot be possible. Ki ein safech ki yoter michamesh meot miyaldot hayu. That he figures out the numbers, he says there have to have been at least 500. Midwives, Elu Shtehem, Sharot Hayu Alehem, Latet Mas Lamelech. Apparently, it was just like a guild or something, that in order to be a midwife, you had to pay your dues, your duty to your guild, and these were the ones who were in charge of collecting the money. V'kachanir Eti Hayom B'mekamot Rabim, and he says, I see this in places that I go to. They're like the head of staff, and they're the ones in charge of the other ones. Ha'em v'habat hayader b'derech kabbalah. And he said it makes sense. It's a mother and daughter because that's something that you keep within the family. That's right. You hand it down. You don't allow other people to get into it. So that is the answer that the Ramban, the Ibn Ezra, gives. Now, so we understand it's either Jewish midwives, midwives of the Jews, who they are, Shifra Puah. Now, the king gives them an outright command, and they refuse. Not only do they refuse, but it says in Pasuk Yud Zayin, Vatichayena et hayiladim. What does it mean, Vatichayena et hayiladim? That they help them live. And if you look in source number 10, which is the Gemara in Masechet Sota, the Gemara says, Vatichayena et hayiladim, Tana, lo dayan shelo himitu otam. It's not even enough that they didn't kill them. They would bring food and water to the slaves to make sure that they had food. And Rashi also tells us that they actually would pray. Look, there was X percent of babies that used to die in childbirth, and they specifically prayed and asked God that nobody should die so that nobody could accuse them of malpractice. And so therefore it says not only did they not kill them, but they allowed them to live. Now when the king comes to them in verse 18 and says to them, why are you not listening to my command? What would we expect them to answer?
We tried.
Yeah, exactly. We expect some sort of outright lie. They didn't call us. Right? Some sort of outright lie to the king, or alternatively, if they're going to disagree with him, why not say to his face, we quit. Right? Find somebody else to do the job. And so it's interesting to see here that these women are not fools. And I think that's the bottom line, that they really, it's not like they're looking to risk their lives here. They are looking to continue because the attitude, if we don't do it, he's going to get rid of us, and who knows who the next ones are going to be. And the answer that they give him is, well, it can't be helped because the Jews are chayot hena. And when I asked you if this was a compliment or not, we got very mixed reviews in this room. Let's play it both ways. Let's say it's a compliment. Then what are they trying to say?
They give birth easily.
They're strong. There are no midwives for the animals out in the forest. And so therefore, by the time we get there, they've already had the babies, and then it's too late for us to do what needs to be done.
So why would that even be midwives?
Because they're not really chayot. They really do.
I know, but the fact that that's the excuse they use, why would the concept of midwife,
right. So they sort of, you say they're sort of shooting themselves in the foot by using that argument.
It's only with girls that give us a midwife.
Right, all of a sudden, right. Only girls need help.
But so what? The babies are already born. They still could have killed them when they got there.
But it's not, remember, he wants to keep this secret. He doesn't want it to be so obvious. So now let's flip it around. Let's say it's negative. Let's say they're saying in a negative way. What would they be trying to say?
They don't know enough.
Like Azov, like what do you want? They're like, you know, they're vermin.
Right.
You know, they're just reproducing, like they're just animals. Like, why are you even bothering to be involved with them? They're so lowly and nobody cares what the animals are doing. Why in the world would you care that it's sort of turning them into subhuman? Which is something that we are familiar with. Now, I think that this is going to be very much connected to if you view them as Jews or if you view them as Egyptians. Depending on who they are, I think that's how you will interpret this sentence. Anyway, verse 20 tells us that...
Fact.
And that they're using... That's right. And so they're just using it to save their skins.
Yes.
100%. And finally, God does them a favor, and the nation multiplies rather than becomes less. And let's move on to this verse 21, where we have this problem with the batim. Who made whom houses? Based on the pshat, who would you say is making whom houses?
Well, the English translation has a capital.
The English translation, see there, every time you work with a translation, you're automatically working with an explanation. Okay, so you want to go with that explanation first,
which would be that
it's God making them houses. Well, what kind of houses is God making for them? So that is the explanation I think that we are most familiar with, because it is the explanation that Rashi brings, which is source 14. Source 14 is Rashi. Vayitev Elohim lemiyaldot. He was good to them. Mahi hatova. What is the goodness that God did to them specifically? Vayas lehem batim. He made for them houses. What kind of houses? Bate kohuna vilivia umachut. That are considered the houses. That who came out of Yocheved? The kohuna. Who comes out of Miriam? Miriam marries into Shevet Yehuda, and her children are the kings. And that, so the reward are houses, not literally, but of kingdom. And now my father, Zechono Livracha, used to love to say that if you think about it for a minute, this is really a reward, midah kenegen midah. Because when Paro is killing the men and leaving the women alive, he's leaving Judaism alive, but he's killing what we call yichs. All of yichs, you're a Kohen because your father's a Kohen. And that, so that by killing out all the men, you're still going to have Jews, but you're not going to have any kahuna, you're not going to have any malchut. So that is why God specifically rewarded them with these ideas. And I think this is the common idea that we are familiar with. However, if you look at source number 13, source number 13 is the Rashbam. He doesn't like that. He says it's not the pshat. Rashbam says, "Vayas lehem batim lishamram, to watch over them, pen yelchu la ivriot hayoldot, lest they go and help them." What would we call that today? Rashbam is saying that who made the houses? Paro. He's putting them under what we would call house arrest. Correct. He's putting them under house arrest. Literally, vayas lehem batim, he is putting them in jail to prevent them from going out. Those are two of the different expressions. There are others, but let's leave it for now. The last question I really want to deal with here about these mieldot is the idea of also why. Why is the story necessary? What is important to the reader? So first of all, as I pointed out, I think this idea of the ability to stand up to immorality is something that is worthwhile discussing. And if you look at the Jews in Egypt, the Jews came down to Egypt, and at the beginning, life was very good for them there. Yosef was king, they had their own area, and they were respected, they were well treated, and in sum, life was pretty good for the Jews in Egypt. And as a matter of fact, this perek begins, remember the beginning of Shemot, begins describing the Yeridat Mitzrayim, reminding us that once there was a Yosef, Yosef dies and a new king arises who doesn't remember Yosef, and then begins all of our story. Now, Rav Yosef Albo in Sefer Ikarim explains that God could say, I'm going to give this farmer 100 bushels of wheat. But in order for that farmer to actually, and so what's, God's going to send the right amount of rain, he's going to send the right amount of sun, there's going to be the right amount of nutrients in the earth, but in order for that man to receive the blessing, what does he have to do? He has to plant. If he doesn't plant, God can make, send as much rain as he wants, God can make as much sun as he wants, but if he doesn't put down the seeds, nothing is going to grow. And this becomes a very important philosophical message throughout our life, that human initiative is necessary to receive God's blessing. The Jews, until this point in time, have sort of accepted their place in life. It's almost like the crab in the pot. You know, the water gets hotter and hotter and hotter. It doesn't necessarily realize that it's happening, and therefore it doesn't jump out. The Jews become slaves sort of quietly, and they end up being stuck in this situation. The mialdot come. The mialdot take that human initiative. They turn around and say to Paro, no. And when they turn around and say no, the next thing that happens is the Jews are beginning to cry out to God. It's only after they see that somebody stands up and says, we're not going to take this, we're not going to accept this type of behavior, and only then do the Jews stand up. So the midwives become the role models for the people, and in essence, that way, two people can really make a difference, and I think we see this now happening this week in Iran.
Yeah.
Right? People start going out to the street, and we only waiting to see how this is going to help us. Now, the last thing I want to point out to you is, even though we say, and I think that that's an important message, we see it also in the book of Esther, why didn't God make Ahasuerus call Esther? Why does it have to be that she risks her life to go? Then again, this idea of the human initiative. When we read this story, somehow, it's still a little bit hard for us to understand why doesn't the king kill them, get somebody else involved. So I found an article online that I want to share with you. Again, I tried to verify the authenticity of it, and I really can't. I found it on a Christian website that describes like this. I didn't even know this. Until May 1943, in Auschwitz, there was actually a maternity ward. Women who came off the train visibly pregnant automatically got sent to the gas chambers, but those who came off who weren't visibly pregnant were sent, you know, they could send to the camp, and then the pregnancy became visible and they were sent to a maternity ward. Until 1943, all children in Auschwitz born were drowned in a barrel. There was a midwife named Schwester Clara, a German, who was later imprisoned for infanticide, and after sitting in jail, she was forbidden to practice her profession. Another woman comes into the camp, a non-Jew, whose name was Stalin Swala, and she was entrusted as a midwife as well. And with she herself tried whatever she could to save the babies. As opposed to this woman who was drowning in the barrel, she did whatever she could. And they said that she used all kinds of techniques. She would wash the healthy, you know, they only had one barrel to wash the babies. She would wash the healthy babies before she washed the... She somehow found food for them and rags, whatever it was that she could do. And then her son describes an encounter with Mengele and described the gruesome settings. The account is not without some humor. When my mother opposed Mengele, who told her to kill all the babies, she said he became furious. And my mother said, I only saw his long boots jumping back and forth, and I heard him shout, an order is an order. Recalling these words many years later, I realized that since my mother was quite small, she had the habit of looking down. When she was thinking about something, she stood with a lowered eyes and saw his long boots nervously jumping in front of her. Was this terrible murderer trying to explain away his order to kill the newborn babies? In any case, neither then nor any other time did he raise a murderous hand against my mother. Didn't kill her. During her imprisonment, Stanislaus delivered 3,000 babies. But it continues, and you can well imagine, and even there was a fortunate inmate, Maria Salomon, it gives her name. She says for weeks, the Stanislaus never had a chance to lay down. She sometimes sat down near one patient, dozed for a minute, jumped up, or ran to another. When she approached me, I knew everything would be all right. My baby lasted 3 months in the camp, but seemed doomed to die of starvation. I was completely devoid of milk. Stanislausa somehow found two women to wet nurse my baby, and to this day I don't know what price she paid, but my Liz owes her life to Stanislausa. So it's what? Okay. So that's the thing. So that which all of a sudden, when you put the story of our Egyptian midwives into a, perhaps it is not as unusual or far-fetched as we think.
Yeah, back to Hatshepsut from Hua, I think that's an example of how Jewish women are usually in the forefront of revolutionary movements.
That's correct, and that was the point that I began with. So either way, whether they're non-Jews or Jews, they are the ones who are responsible for the development of the nation.
Not only Jewish,
right? Women,
worldwide.
Women. That's correct, and once we have the birth of the nation with the Mialdot, we move over to the birth of Moshe, which is in Shmot Perek Bet. Now, we know that, again, they remember at the beginning of Perek Bet, there are no names. A Isham Mibet Levi goes to Ben Levi, again, it's nameless in the book of Shmot. And the child is born, and the mother knows that she can no longer hide the baby, so she makes him a little ark and puts him into the water. Vatered bat Paro lerchotz al hayor. The daughter of Paro, the princess, goes down to bathe in the river. And her maids-in-waiting are strolling on the side of the river. Now, this is also one of those misconceptions that we have as children. We all picture the Teva floating down the Nile, but here clearly we understand that the mother didn't put him in the middle of the Nile. She puts him in the Suf. Suf are those tall, tall reeds that grow at the edge of the river, and that is where. So his teva is not floating down the river with Miriam, you know, jogging along. That's what we picture, but that's not what's happening. She's standing near where the basket is. Vatishlach et amata. She sends out her maidservant, vatikacheha, and she brings it. Vatiftach v'tere'e et hayeled. She opens it up and she sees the boy. V'hine na'ar bocheh. He's crying. Vatachmol alav. And she has mercy on him. Vatomer mialdei ha'ivrim zeh. She understands that it is a Jewish child. Vatomer choto al belt paro. And all of a sudden his sister, who is nameless, comes to Bat Paro, who is nameless. Ha'elech v'karati lach isha meineket min ha'ivriot. Should I get you a wet nurse from the Jews? V'tanek lach et hayeled, to nurse this baby? V'tome lebat paro, and bat paro says to her, lechi, go. V'tailech ha'alma. Now the young maiden goes, this indicates to us that she might be a little bit older. V'tikra el em hayeled, and she calls the boy's mother, nameless. Vatomer lebat paro, halichi et hayeled hazeh veheniki li vani eten et zcharech. The daughter of Paro says to her, look, you nurse this baby, I'll pay you. Vatika haisha hayeled vatinikehu. So this woman takes the baby and nurses him. Vayigdal hayeled, and the boy grows up. 2, 3, vativiehu lebat paro, and she brings him to bat paro, vayid la leven, and he became the adopted son of bat paro, vatikwa shmo Moshe, she names him Moshe because, ki min hamayim mishitihu, because I have drawn him out of the water. Now, this story clearly continues the motif of the midwives. Paro has decreed death on the newborns. The midwives say, we're not doing it. They do not obey him, the risking of their lives. And now Bat Paro is also going against a clear and direct command that her father has given. Now, Bat is really, and by the way, we call the daughter of Paro, we call her Batya, and I'll explain to you why at the end. But she is really one of the most surprising characters in the Tanakh. Now, as opposed to the midwives, who said maybe they're Jewish, maybe they're not, Batya is clearly not. She is clearly not, so she really becomes what we would consider our first righteous Gentile. And Paro is the one who says that you have to kill all the boys in the river, and she is obviously been raised in a palace where there's hatred. What has she been taught from the time she's a child? Kill the Jews. And she has had everything imaginable as princess, and yet she's able to step back and say, this is not okay. And okay, we're going to talk about that momentarily.
Can I just say, in the last year we just talked about seeing the Abba.
Right.
Important to see, and maybe when she saw the baby in the cradle.
Well, we're going to talk about that. But I think that's just as we asked by the Mialdot, I think there are a number of interesting questions that we have to ask here. And I think one of those first questions is, what allows her to see, completely opposite to what she has been raised as? I think that's a very good question. What else do you want to ask?
How did she get away with it?
How did she get away with it? What was she thinking?
She's
a
pharaoh's
daughter. So? Yes, there's this little boy. Right, it's not like she lived someplace else, lived in a different country. Where is she raising Moshe? In the palace. So she's thinking, like, how in the world did she think she was going to get away with it, and how does she?
It can be that if she is a favored daughter, she is protected.
That's great.
She wants it.
Okay, so we're going to get. Let's not get to the answers. Let's first look at the questions as well. I think the other questions we sort of also have to ask is, how does she know he's a Jew? What is she doing by the Yaar? How does, notice also, a fascinating idea is Miriam, which we don't have time to discuss, is her role. Like all of a sudden she's suggesting to the princess what to do. You know, where does that come? And, pardon?
How old is the princess?
That's an excellent question. We don't seem to know, but I will give a suggestion as we go on. And finally, the last question, I think all of those are very much connected. How could she know, and what was she thinking? The name Moshe. What's the problem with the name Moshe? It's a Hebrew name. So you either have to ask, either she speaks Hebrew, or this is a translation of the Egyptian term, Or Abarbanel says actually that she asked Yocheved for a Hebrew translation. We have different ideas, but here you'll see something fascinating. If you look here at source number four tells us, Mikana talomet charan shal gomle chasadim. From here we learn the essence and the reward of somebody who does chesed. Afal pi sheharbe shemot haya l'Moshe. Moshe had, anybody know? How many names? 10. Moshe has 10 names. Some of them you might know. Tuvia, Yekotiel. Right? These are names that are Moshe's names. And but all of Torah, when God addresses him, God always calls him Moshe. Why, you know, Yocheved named him Tuvia. Why do we use the name Moshe? To teach you, lo nikba lo shem b'chol haTorah ela kamod. We only use the name that was given Bat Paro because of the chesed that she does for him. V'af haKadosh Baruch Hu lo karuhu b'shem acher, and even God uses that name that she gave as a result to recognize that she is the one who saved his life, and as a reward, we give her name. The story continues here that according to the Zohar even says that Moshe talks about drawing out, that not only has he drawn out from the water, but Moshe's major goal in life was to draw the Jews out of Mitzrayim. Which brings us to a next question. Does that mean that the daughter of Paro has prophetic knowledge? We'll leave that question for now. Now, based on just the storyline, just on the pshat, before we go into any midrashim, what do you know about this woman? Well, first of all, she's merciful. She sees the baby, he's crying. She feels like she needs to do something. What else?
She's defiant,
yeah. Okay, she is defiant, she's not afraid to stand up against her father and to what she thinks is evil. And we will come back to this in a moment. Let's go back to this question of what is she doing at the Ya'ar. Now the Sfarno points at the river. The Sfarno points out that most of you seem to think that what is she doing at the river?
Washing.
Correct. The Sfarno points out that if you are a princess, you do not bathe in the river. You send your, especially one who has many slaves, you send people down, they lug back water, they heat it up, voila, you have a bath. So the Sfarno is asking, what in the world is she doing by the Yar? So the Sfarno's answer is, she's not by the Yar, she has a window. She sees this from the window, and that's why she sends the maidservant. However, many of you are familiar with the answer that we have here in source number 6. Source number 6 is the Shmot Rabbah, which Rashi brings as well. Vateri bat paro lirchotz al hayor, lirchotz migilulei beit aviha. That she came to wash from the idol worship in her father's house. And if you turn to source number 7 to take it even stronger, Vatere bat paro, sofei tevot data, if you take the letters, milamed, sheshinta data. She, which we would call in English, converts. Shalcha lehit gayer. That she too is coming. That's right. That's why she can't have the bath at home, because she's specifically going down to the river to convert. Now, to convert. Right. So as we pointed out before, it doesn't necessarily mean conversion as we see it. But this whole idea of taking the baby against her father's will is very similar to those midwives who are saying no, who are throwing their lot in with the Jewish people. Now, just what would motivate Rashi, who always tries to bring pshat, to say that she's converting. What in the here is bothering Rashi that he would say that it's pshat? So what is we say, well, why is the princess leaving her palace? That's one. What else? Vatered bat paro lerchotz. What does it say? Al hayor. What should it say? Lerchotz bayor. What is al yor? Why is it used that terminology? In Egypt, the Nile was considered special. It was considered holy. And remember, that's the whole idea with Paro, as though when she's lerchotz al hayor, she's trying to say, I'm rejecting the yor as a god, and I'm going above the Yor. So that's one of the clues that Rashi uses. The second clue that Rashi uses is a logical thought, because how else, why else would she save the baby, and why else doesn't she bathe at home? Now, stay with me here. What day was Moshe born? You know this. Moshe is born on Zion Adar. He's born on Zion Adar and he dies on Zion Adar. How old is he now?
3 months.
What month is it? Adar to Nisan. Nisan to Iyar. Iyar to Sivan. The date that Moshe is saved from the Yor by Bat Paro is Zion Sivan. What is the significance of Zion Sivan? It's Shavuot. It's Chag Matan Torah. So therefore, what is he doing at the Yor? She is going through a private conversion, saving the baby who is going to bring the one who brings Torah to Am Yisrael. And what do Am Yisrael do when they receive the Torah? They are essentially going through a national conversion at that point in time. If you look at source number 11, he doesn't say Zion. Amar Rabbi Acha Bar Chanina, Oto Yom Shisha B'Sivan Haya. There must have been another day, Rosh Chodesh, and that's how he gets. I don't think it really matters whether it's Vav or Zion. Amu Machi Asharet Lifnei Hakadosh Baruch Hu. Mi She'atid Lekabel Torah Mihar Sinai B'Yom Zeh. Yilakeh B'Yom Zeh. Is it possible that Moshe is going to die here in the Yor on this day when he is the one who's supposed to bring down Torah? And so therefore God sends Bat Paro to save him. But I think that that also has to do with the idea of saying there has to be more to her going down to the Yor, that she's part of. And therefore, by the way, how does she know that he's Jewish? Okay, so first of all, you don't have to be a mental giant to say who else would put their baby, except, remember, if you look back in Shmot Perek Aleph, Vayitzav Paro l'chol amo lemar, there are opinions that even the Egyptian males had to be thrown into the river. Why? Because Paro's astrologers saw that the Savior was going to come. But because Moshe grew up in the Egyptian house, the astrologers couldn't tell if it was a Jew or Egyptian. So therefore, Paro, to be safe, said, kill all. So you can't necessarily say that who else would put their baby in the Yor, because perhaps the Egyptians did it as well. So how does she know that he's a Jew? One opinion, and I think the most common, is that he had a Brit Milah. That's one opinion. But the second opinion is that if she's going through a conversion process, remember when he's born, the house is filled with light. She opens the basket, and what is she zocha to see? She sees that light. And at that point, she understands that her conversion has been accepted. She understands that there's something unusual about this child. And what is her first act as a Jew? Is to save the child. Right. Her first act as a Jew, we know that that's one of those signs of a Jew, that if you see somebody who is not compassionate, you should ask about their Judaism. And her first act of a Jew is to save this child. I'm going to come to that. There are other opinions here, by the way, what she was doing by the Yor. There is another opinion that she actually had Tzara'at, which I brought for you here, and perhaps she needed the flowing water to get the leprosy, and when she touches the basket, the leprosy disappears, and that's how she knows it's something. There's another opinion that God sent Sharav, and you know as well as I do that Sharav can be quite uncomfortable. So there are different opinions as to what she's doing down by the Yaar, but this best one seems to be the conversion. Now, taking it a step further, we know this business, and this also you all learned from the time you were in Gan, right? She goes out to the Yaar, and who does she send to get the baby? Her maidservant. But those of you who went to Gan know that not only, that's right, not only did she send her maidservant, if you look at the Pasuk says to us, Vatishlach et Amata. Amata is translated as maidservant. In Gan, they taught you that Amata also refers to her hand, and how many of you went through life picturing Bat Paro, you know, with one shorthand and one really long hand, right? Okay, and they teach that to you when you're in Gan, and then you never relearn it. And so that I do want to spend a minute or two asking, how are we supposed to understand, what is the Midrash trying to tell us? What's this idea of extending her arm and her arm reaching? The Midrash is trying to say that there are many times where something needs to be done, and something important needs to be done. As we, as individuals, say to ourselves, can't do it, my arm won't reach. It's too big for me. It's not within arm's reach. And here, by God stretching our hand in the Midrash, God is saying that, again, sometimes we have to do that human initiative. We have to do that, we have to extend our hand, and God will make the basket, or the hand, whatever it needs to be done, stretched in order to help it achieve this idea, which is very similar to our Mialdot concept. The idea is we have to do something, and God does his. Okay, so you've asked me that. How old is Bat Paro? We don't know how old Bat Paro is, but we do know a number of things about her. First of all, and let's come back to this question, and I'll answer it together, is why does she think that she can get away with bringing this baby into the river, from the river into the house? So now, the one thing we do know about Bat Paro is we know that Bat Paro is a firstborn child. Now that becomes significant because as a firstborn, in source number 16, you will see that when it comes Makat Bechorot, you know that Makat Bechorot was not only firstborn sons, but it was also firstborn daughters. So therefore, Bat Paro Bechora Haita. She was a firstborn. Ubizchut ma batya nitzla. And so why was she saved? Bitfilato shel Moshe. Moshe prays for her that God should save her, and he does. Now, I don't know this for sure, but it seems to me I think that makes sense to say here that Batya must be an older woman who does not have her own children. That's what seems to be make sense, and that she brings this child home finally, and Paro can't say to her, get rid of him, kill him, because as a firstborn child, she has a certain place in her heart, and he wants her to have this child. And therefore, take a look, we'll just take a quick look at source number 12 and 13, which are another stories that you know. V'tivi'ehu bat paro, she's brought to bat paro. Haita bat paro minasheket umichabeket umichavevet oto. She loved him. That's why it has to, I really feel like, based on these machines, that she must not have had her own. Ke'elu hayu ke'ilu hu bana. She really treated him as her son. V'lo haitam motziato mipatrin shel melech. And she never took him outside. Lefi shehaya yafeh kol mitavim le'oto. He was so beautiful that everybody would have wanted to look for him, and they couldn't take their eyes off of him. V'haya paro minashko u'michabko. Even Paro used to hug him and kiss him. At this point, perhaps Paro doesn't have any other grandchildren. And you all know that medrash about how he holds on the lamp and he takes the crown. We don't need to go into that as well. It's at the end of that midrash. Now let me just make a quick point. Why is it important for Moshe to grow up in the palace?
No slave mentality.
First of all, that's idea right. No slave mentality. He needs to lead the people. He needs to learn leadership. He needs his brethren to respect him and listen into him. And then, of course, the irony here of this story is that Paro makes a decree to kill all the boys, and in the end, Paro ends up raising that, right, you know, and this idea that, you know, that's a really perfect example of man plans and God's laughs. And so we have this idea that Paro, that Paro's daughter, Batya, is so different from her father. And we know that she is so successful in giving over those messages to Moshe. Right after this story, Moshe, the next pasuk says, Moshe grows up and goes out to his brothers, and he sees them fighting, and he says, Rasha lamata kerecha, and he defends the Jewish people. Where does Moshe, if he's being raised from the age of two or three, where does he learn to stand up for the one who is being abused? Where does he learn? From his mother, who is from Batya. But from Yocheved is quite small. You know, he's been with Batya since he's two or three years old, which indicates to us that a lot of Moshe's greatness is actually coming from this woman. How does he know that they're his brothers even? Because she must have told him, that's right, that she must have been throwing her lot in here, and it's obvious that he is really being raised by an incredible woman who is the antithesis of her father, and she is teaching him his identity, she's teaching him compassion, she's teaching him responsibility. Now, what happens to her? Look at source 2. Where is it? Look at source 2. Source 2 is a pasuk in Divrei Hayamim. Difficult pasuk. Now, you know, Divrei Hayamim is listing, you know, chronology of families, and it says, V'ishto ha-Yehudia yalda et Yered Avigdor Chever Avizcho et Yikutiel Avizanoach Elu b'nei Batya bat Paro asher lakach Mered. Okay, so first of all, we get her name as, sometimes you'll hear it called Bitya, which is written here. Sometimes you hear it pronounced Batya. Now, it could very well be that that was her original name. Why could it be that that was her original name? Because Paro himself thought that he was God, so he names his daughter Batya, the daughter of God. Or, as you know, that is a name that converts themselves take on the name of Bitya Batya, which is here. Now, we need to figure out... Yes. Yes. Let's talk about who's Mered. Who is Mered? Mered, according to source number 14, which is the Gemara in Megillah, Mered ze Kalev. Kalev ben Yefune shemarad ba'atzat miraglim. Why? Haita zu bat paro shemarda be'etzat aviha. Yavo moreid v'yikach et ha-moredet. We're making a shidduch, here between those who rebel against their societies. She rebels against her father. Kalev rebels against the miraglim. And she, so in other words, now, by the way, who is Yered, Avigdor, Cheved, Avisochel, Yikutiel, Avizanoah? According to the Medrash, those are all names of Batya's children, but those are also all names of Moshe. Remember I told you Moshe had 10 names? These are 7 of his 10 names, which is another proof that I want to say. Remember I told you before that I wanted to say that she had no children of her own. And here, all the children that are born are all different names for Moshe, which proves my point. Now, right. Right, it's a problem. It's a problem. The verse is awkward here. The verse is awkward here, but in other words, I think the important point is, it seems to be that Batya doesn't die in Egypt. She leaves with Moshe and the Jews, and creates for herself some sort of of new life afterwards. Okay, and if you look at source 17 is the Medrash and Mishle. Now, many of you might be familiar with this, that the Eish HaChayil, there's a Medrash that goes that each Pasuk applies to a different woman in Jewish history. All righteous women, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Leah. Vatakam biod laila, she gets up while it's night. Zu batya bat paro, so she gets into that list with all these other Jewish women. Goya haita, she was a Gentile. Vinaset Yehudia, and she became a Jew, hence Eshet Yehudia. Viskiria shema ben haksharot, and she becomes listed among those respectable women, Bishvil Sha'aska Moshe, because she took care of Moshe, Lefila Zachta V'Nichnasa B'Chayecha L'Gan Eden. Right, because it says, V'Takam Ba'od Laila, Lo Tichbe B'Laila Neira. The candle never goes out. So according to the Medrash, she was one of the four people who actually entered Gan Eden alive. As again, it doesn't necessarily have to be literal, but it does have that idea of the importance of what she did. And if you click back on the other sheet, I'm going to leave you with that, you'll see source 6. Remember, I was giving you all the lists of the Nashim who converted. I stopped right before Bat Paro. And they also have Rachav, Rut, Yael. All of them are converts. And so, to conclude, you will notice something else about this story is that it's women who are responsible here, and in our story of Bat Paro, the name of God does not appear in the passage at all. But this idea that God is acting through humans, those humans here at this point who are women, his presence is sensed. But Torah is giving central stage to these wise, brave, energetic women who are leading the redemption of Israel. And therefore, when it says it's because of righteous women that we got out of Egypt, we're used to thinking it's the women, you know, with the husbands, and they're going out to greet them. But here we see clearly, if you look at the Mi'aldot and you look at Batya Bat Paro, we have to look at them as being an essential part of the redemption as well.